Beverly is a 55-year-old African-American man who submitted an affidavit to Judge Denby's court stating that he, not Mumia Abu-Jamal, killed police officer Daniel Faulkner on December 9, 1981. And Beverly videotaped a confession, which was also submitted to Judge Denby, with the idea that this key new witness would come forward in court and submit himself to whatever legal procedures, and that would exonerate Mumia Abu-Jamal.
From the studios of Freak Radio 96.3 FM in Santa Cruz, California, it's time for the weekly Freak Show for Sunday, December 9th, 2001. My name's the V-Man, and I'll be your host for this one-hour examination of the news and events not heard in or glanced over by the corporate-controlled media. On this week's program, we'll be examining the latest developments in the case of death row inmate and award-winning journalist Mumia Abu-Jamal on this, the 20-year anniversary of his imprisonment. We'll hear from his attorney, Elliot Grossman, an interview with Jeff Mackler on the case, and later, Taina Valle will join us live to talk about police brutality at a demonstration in Philadelphia. Plus, this week's Spotlight Sound. Stand by for the Weekly Freak Show, coming up next. Twenty years have passed since police officer Daniel Faulkner was found dead on a Philadelphia street corner. But for award-winning journalist Mumia Abu-Jamal, today, December 9th, marks the second decade of a hellish nightmare. Convicted of the officer's murder in July 1982, Abu-Jamal has been on Pennsylvania's death row ever since. But his incarceration has been condemned worldwide by supporters who say the original trial was marred by prosecutorial and judicial misconduct. Falsified ballistics evidence was introduced, witness testimony was coerced by police, and the dismissal of 11 qualified African-American jurors are some elements of an unfair trial, they say. Abu-Jamal has survived two warrants for his execution, one in August 1995 and again in December 1999. Listeners of this show may remember in May 2001, we reported on new evidence in the case. At the time, a new legal team took over the case after Abu-Jamal fired his former attorneys, Leonard Weinglass and Dan Williams, after Williams published a book purported to be an inside account of the case. Among the documents turned over to the new legal team was a videotaped murder confession by a man named Arnold Beverly.
I, Arnold Beverly, state that the following facts are true and correct. I was present when Officer Daniel Faulkner was shot and killed in the early morning hours of December 9, 1981, near the corner of 13th and Locust Street. I have personal knowledge that Mumia Abu-Jamal did not shoot Officer Daniel Faulkner. In fact, I was hired, along with another guy, and paid to shoot and kill Officer Daniel Faulkner. I had heard that Faulkner was a problem for the mob and the corrupt policemen because he interfered with the graft and the payoff made to allow illegal activities, including prostitution, gambling, drugs, without prosecution in the Center City area. Faulkner was shot once in the back, then in the face, before Jamal came onto the scene. Again, Jamal had nothing to do with the shooting of Officer Faulkner. Before the shooting, I was given a picture of Faulkner. I was told that he would be around Locust Street to check something out at Johnny D's bar in the early morning hours of December 9th. Two of us were hired for the shooting so that either of us could take the opportunity to make the hit, get the job done, and leave. The other guy gave me a .38 caliber policeman special. I also was carrying my own .22 caliber revolver. I was waiting at the speed line entrance, northeast corner of 13th and Locust Street, at the parking lot. I was wearing a green camouflage jacket. The other guy was at the south side of Locust Street, east of 13th Street, near Camac. While I was waiting at the speed line for Faulkner to arrive on the location, I saw police officers in the area. Two undercover policemen were standing on the west side of 13th Street. also a uniform officer, was sitting in a car at the parking lot. They were there while the shooting of Faulkner took place. I was not worried about the police there, since I believed that since I was hired by the mob to shoot and kill Faulkner, any police officer that were there to help me and protect me. After a while, I saw Faulkner get out of a small police car behind a VW parked on Locust Street east of 13th. Faulkner was alone. He got out of the police car and went up to VW. I heard a shot ring out from east on Locust Street. Faulkner fell to one knee on the sidewalk next to the VW. I heard another shot, and it must have grazed my left shoulder. I felt something on my left shoulder. I grabbed at my shoulder and got blood on my hand. I ran across the street, stood over top of Faulkner, and shot him in the face at close range. Jamal was shot shortly after that by a uniformed police officer who arrived on the scene. Cop cars came from all directions. Foot patrol also arrived. I saw a white shirt, brass, getting out of a car in the middle of 13th Street, just as I was going down the speed line steps. I left the area underground through the speed line system, and by prearrangement, a police officer who assisted me when I exited the speed line underground about one block away, a car was waiting for me, and I left the Center City area.
This confession by Arnold Beverly has been corroborated by several eyewitnesses and substantiated by forensic evidence and a lie detector test. In May of this year, Abu Jamal's legal team filed this and other evidence simultaneously in both federal court and Pennsylvania state court, seeking to have Arnold Beverly deposed. Included in the evidence filed were new affidavits from Billy Cook, Abu Jamal's brother, and Abu Jamal himself, who for the first time has stated publicly what happened on the night of December 9th, 1981. Attorney Elliot Grossman spoke on December 7th in Santa Cruz. Here he explains Abu Jamal's version of events.
What basically happened, insofar as Mumia has his slice of that reality, is that he was in his cab, parked in front of one of these after-hour clubs at 13th and Locust at 4 in the morning, waiting for people to come out of the club to get a customer. That's what all the cab drivers did. That's where you went to go get customers. He heard gunfire. He turned and looked down Locust Street where the gunfire was coming from, and he sees his brother standing there looking dazed. He gets out of his cab, runs toward his brother, and all of a sudden he's shot and he goes down. And that's it. And before he was shot, he sees a uniformed police officer turn, has a gun in his hand, gun goes off, and he's shot.
In July, Federal District Court Judge William H. Yawn Jr. denied the motion, citing the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act of 1996, which grants a presumption of correctness to state court findings. Then in August, Abu Jamal had a hearing in Philadelphia in front of State Court Judge Pamela Demby. More than 1,000 of his supporters turned out, but Abu Jamal was denied the right to be present. His attorneys petitioned the court for a new Post-Conviction Relief Act hearing in which the new evidence could be presented.
Petitioner Mumia Abu Jamal has been in prison for 20 years and is awaiting execution for a crime he did not commit. Another man, Arnold Beverly, has confessed to the crime and exonerated Petitioner Jamal. Shocking evidence has just now surfaced of racist prejudice against Mr. Jamal and connivance with the prosecution by the trial and post-conviction judge, Albert Sable, providing what is now overwhelming proof that Mr. Jamal did not receive a fair trial or fair post-conviction hearing. The petition which initiated these proceedings details the manifold conflicts of interest by Mumia Abu Jamal's ex-chief counsel, Leonard Weinglass, and ex-chief legal strategist, Daniel R. Williams, which infected their representation from its inception, motivated them to ignore, jettison, or sabotage numerous meritorious claims for relief, prevented them from putting forward Arnold Beverly's confession and other compelling evidence of Mr. Jamal's innocence when they had such evidence in hand, and caused them to deceive Mr. Jamal into believing they were always acting in his interests, when instead they were sacrificing him on the altar of their personal best interests. Their fear for their own lives and safety, as well as their careers and reputations, and their desperation to cover up the pattern of deceit they had practiced on Mr. Jamal over the years.
On Wednesday, November 21st, the day before Thanksgiving, Pennsylvania State Court Judge Pamela Dembe issued a ruling also rejecting the consideration of the Arnold Beverly confession. Citing a number of technical matters, Dembe claims she lacks jurisdiction to hear the case and that the evidence was submitted too late. Again, attorney Elliot Grossman.
What has happened is that Judge Dembe has issued an opinion, according to the procedures they have in Pennsylvania, where she is giving us notice that she intends to throw us out of state court, and we have the right to file a written response as to why she shouldn't throw us out and why we should get a hearing. We filed that response today, and I'm going to read you a portion of that response. The case of petitioner Abu Jamal, in which evidence has recently been brought forward, which proves that the trial and post-conviction judge, the notorious Judge Sabo, had remarked at the time of petitioner's original trial, yeah, I'm going to help him fry the N-word, and that petitioner Jamal is in fact innocent, should make it abundantly clear that this case is, to borrow the words of the Philadelphia Inquirer, another case that casts troubling doubts on the fairness of the death penalty, a system that disproportionately condemns minorities and the poor, and sometimes even the innocent.
With more on this story, we turn to Freak Radio's Old Lady Scar Arms, who recently spoke with Jeff Mackler, coordinator of the San Francisco-based Mobilization to Free Mumia Abu Jamal.
Apparently, Judge Dembe felt that it was worth her while to release the decision to the media before she did it to the legal team, which has been a typical occurrence in Philadelphia courts in regard to Mumia's case. Judge Dembe said things like, the courts look askance at confessions like Arnold Beverly, who was central to Mumia's request for a new Post-Conviction Relief Act hearing. Judge Dembe denied that.
Arnold Beverly, can you tell us who he is, quickly?
Arnold Beverly is a 55-year-old African-American man who submitted an affidavit to Judge Dembe's court stating that he, not Mumia Abu Jamal, killed police officer Daniel Faulkner on December 9, 1981. And Beverly videotaped a confession, which was also submitted to Judge Dembe, with the idea that this key new witness would come forward in court and submit himself to whatever legal procedures, and that would exonerate Mumia Abu Jamal. Arnold Beverly passed a lie detector test administered by Dr. Charles Hunts, who is one of the leading specialists in that field, and the lie detector test confirmed the truth of his confession.
Aside from the lie detector test, is this a believable story? I mean, that's strong evidence there that he passed a polygraph, but do his statements match up with others at the scene? Is this a believable story that Arnold Beverly is telling when he's confessing to having killed Officer Faulkner?
Well, since the Beverly confession, which was the first piece of information that the new legal team submitted to the courts, there have been several other critical pieces of evidence to substantiate it. Beverly claims that he was hired by Philadelphia police in collaboration with the mob to kill Faulkner, the police officer, who was interfering with mob and illegal activities in the red light area in Philadelphia where Faulkner was assigned to patrol. And they have an affidavit. The defense submitted an affidavit by one Donald Hersing, who was essentially an employee of the FBI, a confidential security informant, who was working with the Department of Justice and FBI in order to nail a number of the corrupt police in Philadelphia for illegal activities. As a result of Hersing's activity and a long-term investigation of the Justice Department, the government was able to file charges against, seek indictments, and win convictions against scores of corrupt Philadelphia policemen who were not only involved in illegal payoffs and illegal activities, gambling, crime, and so on, but who falsified evidence on a routine basis in order to place countless numbers of Philadelphia citizens in jail when they were innocent. The result of that investigation, the result of those convictions, was the release of huge numbers of people from Philadelphia jails who had been framed up by the police department. Hersing cites one police officer named Alfonso Giordano, who was the chief officer responsible for the crime scene on the night that Daniel Faulkner was killed. In fact, it was Alfonso Giordano who stated that on the way to the hospital, Mumia had confessed that he was the murderer of Faulkner. Interestingly enough, his testimony was not used in the proceedings against Mumia.
Giordano's.
Because Hersing himself was indicted and convicted of corruption, and they figured that his word wouldn't be worth much. So although he had a signed statement saying that Mumia confessed to the murder, they didn't bother to bring the statement into court.
You mean Giordano?
That's right.
Giordano was the one who was convicted by the Justice Department? Is that who convicted him?
Well, he was convicted by Philadelphia courts after the Justice Department brought charges.
Investigated it.
And the same was the case with several other police officers. Then you had the testimony of Mumia's brother, Billy, who claimed that he was on the scene, that Mumia did not do the shooting, and that there was a second person in the car with him, who was Kenneth Freeman. Freeman and Cook had been stopped by police officer Faulkner on the night of Faulkner's murder. And the police always insisted that Billy Cook, Mumia's brother, was the only one in the car. And now Billy Cook comes forward and says, no, there was another person in the car, Kenneth Freeman. And of course, the veracity of that statement became obvious when in Cook's own trial for assault a month before Mumia's 1981 trial, the police and prosecutor admitted that there was a second person in his car. And the same prosecution insisted that there was only one person, Cook, in the car. But in essence, five eyewitnesses said that they saw one or two people flee the scene while Mumia lay in a pool of his own blood on the murder scene. So now you have Billy Cook confirming not only that there was another person on the scene wearing the clothes that witnesses saw at the time of the murder, but you have him say, Billy Cook, in his own statement, that Kenneth Freeman confessed to him that he was one of the two people who were part of the hit team that killed Faulkner.
What ultimately happened to Ken Freeman? Can he be
Freeman
interrogated?
Was found mysteriously murdered in 1985 on the day of the MOVE bombing. So he's no longer available to testify.
How was he killed?
How was he killed?
Yes.
From what I understand, he was killed from an overdose of drugs, a mysterious overdose. It was an implication that the overdose was not his own doing. The defense team has produced an affidavit by a private investigator named Michael Newman, who testified that one of the two key prosecution witnesses against Mumia, Schobert, Robert Schobert, who was a cab driver, who was one of the central people at Mumia's trial and at Mumia's first 1995 post-conviction relief act hearing. He was to say that Mumia was the killer. Well, anyway, Michael Newman stated point blank that Schobert, in a private meeting with him, recanted his testimony, said that he wasn't even on the murder scene, that his cab was parked around the corner, that he did not see the events, and that essentially he was a police stooge witness in order to send Mumia to death.
Now, why would Robert Schobert do that? Why would he lie on the witness stand?
It was clear that he lied from the very beginning, because his original statement to the police was he saw the shooter ran away. He wrote a second statement that the shooter ran a number of yards away. And finally, when he got into the courthouse, he forgot his previous sworn testimony and said that the shooter was Mumia and he didn't run anywhere. He just died. Schobert was convicted of throwing a bomb in a schoolyard, a Molotov cocktail. He was driving without a license, and he was allowed to continue after the Mumia trial to drive without a license. His license has been suspended. And it's clear that the police had material on him to put him in jail. That's a possible explanation.
Mm-hmm.
But it's quite striking that a private investigator now reports that he interviewed Schobert, who recanted his testimony.
So basically, the evidence, this is some of the evidence that was presented to Judge Pamela Demby recently, and she denied the new PCRA hearing, which was basically an appeal. So just let me run down these things that you just mentioned. You mentioned Donald Hersing.
Hersing was a confidential security informant hired on to become a part of an organized crime network, which included mob elements and the Philadelphia police in regard to prostitution, drugs, gambling, and so on.
And he's willing to testify on behalf of Mumia that this was in fact going on.
That's right. And that among those police involved in the illegal activities in the area of the murder was Alphonse Giordano, who was the chief person in charge of the police investigation of the crime scene and the person who claimed that Mumia was the killer.
And who then was convicted by Philadelphia courts for corruption.
That's right.
And then you mentioned Mumia's brother, William, is his name, Billy Cook?
Both.
He stated that Kenneth Freeman was in the car with him, and Kenneth Freeman is he fits the description of one of those who was on the scene who, according to eyewitnesses, fled the scene. And there was also something else connecting Kenneth Freeman. There was a license, correct?
Freeman was so tied into it. They found a driver's license on the body of the slain police officer, Faulkner. And when they went to find the person who had the license, he had an Iron Clan alibi. Oh. He was at some, 7-Eleven station, but he claimed that he gave his driver's license to Kenneth Freeman. It now appears from official affidavits filed in the police department that Kenneth Freeman was put in a lineup that night, along with the actual owner of the driver's license, and was identified as one of the shooters that night. And the person who identified Freeman was Cynthia White. Mm. Cynthia White, and this is also a new affidavit submitted to Judge Denby's court, Cynthia White was the key eyewitness against Mumia at his 1981 trial. And by the way, Mumia himself, a new affidavit, Mumia himself formally requested of the Philadelphia Police Department to be placed in a lineup. And the police rejected his request to be placed in that lineup on the grounds that there were no eyewitnesses. So Mumia's request was denied. How many people do you know of would voluntarily request to be placed in a police lineup to be identified as a killer if they thought they were the killer? And then it turns out that Cynthia White, who after these events, after identifying Kenneth Freeman, turns up as the chief witness against Mumia. No one else on the crime scene remembered even seeing Cynthia White on the crime scene, and she has subsequently disappeared. She's been gone for a long time, perhaps a decade, and it turns out that she identified Kenneth Freeman, not Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Interesting. And then the third point you brought up was that Robert Chobert, one of the few witnesses for the prosecution, recanted his testimony to someone who is willing to state that in court.
That's right.
Uh-huh. And also, of course, the Arnold Beverly confession that you mentioned, and Arnold Beverly, as you said, has passed a lie detector test. And his story, you're saying that it is believable based on the lie detector test, as well as Donald Hersing's testimony that he was part of the corruption that the Justice Department investigated at the time of the killing of Officer Faulkner, that it was pinned on Mumia?
That's right. If you put all the testimony together, you get a very clear picture of what happened that night. And this picture, for the first time, details virtually minute by minute how police officer Faulkner was killed. And it's clear that Mumia Abu-Jamal was not even on the scene at the time. While Mumia was sitting in his own cab, which the police now misidentified its location, the owner of the cab that Mumia was driving came forth to refute police testimony as to where the taxi that Mumia was driving was. And it was clear that the rough scenario was that Mumia was riding up a fare. He saw his brother staggering next to a police car. At that time, shots had already been fired. Faulkner had already been killed. The shooters had already been seen by eyewitnesses running away. And Mumia appears on the scene with his brother staggering, having been hit minutes before on the head by a 14-inch flashlight owned by Faulkner, who had stopped him. Because apparently, according to Billy's confession, he hassled the police officer, was told, got hit on the head, was told to go back into his cab to find some identification. While he was in the cab, the shots rang out. Faulkner was slain. Beverly states that he went over to Faulkner point blank and blew his head away. Other shots were previously fired by Kenneth Freeman into Faulkner's back. Mm-hmm. And during this entire scenario, Mumia was not on the scene. When Mumia approached the scene with no gun whatsoever, he was shot by a police officer on the scene. Mm-hmm. And his body lay next to Faulkner.
So
Beverly's confession states that the police were on the scene, that they did not interfere with the murder, and that, in fact, when he fled in the subway, he was met at the other end and escorted away from the scene by Philadelphia police officers.
My name is Mumia Abu-Jamal. I'm a journalist, a husband, a father, a grandfather, and an African-American. I live in the fastest-growing public housing tract in America. In 1981, I was a reporter for WUHY-FM and president of the Philadelphia Association of Black Journalists. Currently, I'm a writer and public radio commentator. I've been a resident on Pennsylvania's death row for more than 15 years.
To break free is to begin to heal the broken inner self, to save the soul from dancing with Shaitan.
But you see,
the battle wages on.
The battle wages beyond.
As we sit unified,
in trying to identify,
minutes are ticking away and seconds fly by.
And I can hear the piercing cry for freedom when thinking twice about sparing a dime.
Signing on a petition line,
a flyer,
speaking out for what's right.
Raising her hand to question what's wrong.
When thinking twice could lose yet another life. Mumia Abu-Jamal
sits framed beyond the solitary confines of his cell walls for crimes he never committed,
but instead for words he admitted, speaking out,
for the silence,
teaching others,
to find strength,
fighting back
against brutality,
standing up
against injustice.
Mumia Abu-Jamal,
a people's hero, sits awaiting an unwarranted execution,
signed by injustices draped in death clocks. Minutes are ticking away and seconds fly by.
Let me bring it back home.
He is innocent. Kwang Chung Kao, an innocent civilian.
Asian man.
Shot to death in shady Sonoma County circumstances by brutal badges in front of his own home.
They claimed he appeared to take a threatening martial arts stance.
Kwang Chung Kao.
Father.
Husband.
Neighbor.
Hero to his children.
Let me bring it back home.
He is innocent.
As we sit unified
and trying to identify,
minutes are ticking away and seconds fly by.
But you see,
the battle wages on.
The battle wages beyond. To break free
is to begin to heal the broken inner self.
To break free
is to save the soul from dancing with Shaitan.
But you see,
the battle wages on.
The battle wages beyond. To break free
is to learn about the self.
To learn to extend the self.
To extend the self beyond the systematic doctrines they feed you.
Beyond these city walls.
Beyond your circle of friends.
To extend the self to fight for freedom.
To fight a system that enlists soldiers to step on those deemed
less than pure. To release our rage.
Unleash our voices.
Refuse and resist.
Stand in solidarity.
Fuck those who persist to deny us our right to cry for justice.
To fight for freedom.
To live for peace.
To live for peace.
As we sit unified.
In trying to identify.
Minutes are ticking away and seconds fly by.
From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
From the studios of Freak Radio, 96.3 FM in Santa Cruz, California, you're tuned to the Weekly Freak Show on Party Town Radio, webcasting to the world at www.partytown.com/radio. Please have a pen and paper ready to take down our contact info at the end of this one-hour broadcast. That was this week's Spotlight Sound for Mumia by performance artist I Was Born With Two Tongues, available on the compilation 175 Progress Drive. And now back to Old Lady Scararms and Jeff Mackler.
So we have all this new evidence in addition to a wealth of other evidence that has never been seen by a jury. There's also a couple other bits of new evidence, and I want to mention those. I remember hearing that there was a court stenographer who had overheard Judge Albert Szabo during the original trial making very racist statements. Is this true?
That was Terry Maurer. Terry Maurer Carter, I believe her name is, was a award-winning court stenographer in the courthouse where Judge Albert Szabo worked, and she said when she was proceeding through the courthouse, she passed by the chambers of Judge Szabo and overheard him talking about the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal and saying, quote, "I'm going to help him fry the nigger."
She
that
recently came forward.
Additional evidence that points to the fact that Judge Szabo, who would achieve the reputation of the hanging judge for having executed or sent more people to their death than any sitting judge in the United States, was far from lacking in prejudice. The whole point is that Judge Demby had all this information. She had a video confession. She had affidavit after affidavit demonstrating that Mumia was not the shooter, that he was not on the scene, that he could not have been the shooter, that he asked, for the first time it came out, that he asked to be identified, that the police said that there were no eyewitnesses. And then you have a man that says, "I killed the cop,"
agents that say that the mob was involved, that the chief investigating officer was indicted and convicted for corrupt activities, that a whole layer of the Philadelphia Police Department went to jail, that perhaps scores, if not 100 people released from jail, that Mumia was the chief critic of the police officers at that particular time, that the mayor and former chief of police had warned Mumia that he was going to be held responsible for his critical reporting, that he was the leading journalist in town attacking police brutality, that the organization that he defended had been a chief victim of police brutality. It's clear that Mumia Abu-Jamal is an innocent, framed-up man, and that Judge Demby doesn't want to get her court or the state of Philadelphia involved in what is go down in history as a historic frame-up of an innocent black man. All Mumia is asking for is a new state post-conviction relief act hearing, and Judge Demby has apparently ruled, according to the Associated Press, that she has no jurisdiction in the case. And the only way she could raise such a jurisdictional question is if she would invoke the statute of limitations, that is, the time of 1 year after Beverly confessed the defense team did not submit the evidence. And that is, sorry, we have this evidence now that Mumia is innocent, but according to the law, you submitted it beyond the 1 year time period. You were a year or 6 months too late, and therefore Mumia's innocence is irrelevant.
So basically saying time has run out on this confession, ignoring the fact that he fired his previous legal team and now has a new one. This is one of the first decisions that they made, was to use this affidavit by Arnold Beverly, and that's all ignored. And the fact that this man has passed a lie detector test, and that his story matches that of other witnesses at the scene and is believable according to other new evidence such as Donald Herzing's testimony. This is all just basically is the judge saying it's too late to hear evidence of innocence?
Too late and irrelevant. In fact, Judge Demby was virtually advised by the federal court judge that also has concurrent jurisdiction in the case, William H. Yon. She was advised by Yon, who issued a decision on the case as well in regard to the Beverly confession, to ignore the Beverly confession on the grounds that it is barred because it is beyond the time limit. But Judge Yon went further. He cited the infamous 1993 Herrera decision of the U.S. Supreme Court, wherein the court held that innocence is no defense. Judge Yon's decision was incredible. He literally said that even if the Beverly confession was credible, it's irrelevant because it's too late. Innocence is no defense, he said.
So technicalities take precedence over truth and proof of innocence.
That's right. In the United States today, as you saw in the case of Gary Graham, Shaka Sankofa was his African name, they had five eyewitnesses who said that Gary Graham was with them at the time of the murder. You had a sheriff who had arrested Graham saying that the gun that he had could not have been the murder weapon. That is, the arresting officer said that Graham could not have been the killer. And yet they executed Gary Graham because the evidence that I mentioned was submitted too late. Innocence is no defense, they say, barring some constitutional violation. And if there is no formal constitutional question involved, the fact that you're innocent, the fact that there are eyewitnesses that can prove your innocence, the fact that people saw the real shooter run away, the fact that a man comes forward and says, I killed the police officer that the other man is going to be slain for, is irrelevant under American law. That's the hypocrisy of the system. This is a desperate, legal, corrupt legal system that is designed to railroad people to death despite their innocence. In fact, prior to the 1996 Effective Death Penalty Act signed by President Clinton, 40% of all state court convictions were reversed on appeal to the federal courts. It was the norm to reverse state court convictions because they had these elements in them. When the investigators and the legal specialists and scientists began to analyze why it was that 40% of state court convictions were reversed, they came up with things like ineffective assistance of counsel, falsified police evidence, planting evidence, police lying, and so on. And every one of these elements was part of Mumia's case. And now we have new elements. We have the direct involvement of organized crime in the Philadelphia Police Department in the murder of Police Officer Faulkner and in the shooting of Mumia Abu-Jamal.
So you're saying that the Effective Death Penalty Act that was signed into law by Clinton after the Oklahoma City bombing, kind of in reaction to that, has sent things downhill big time for those on death row?
Absolutely. It is the chief law
that is hanging over Mumia's head today. As Judge Yon said in the federal court citing the Effective Death Penalty Act, I must grant a presumption of correctness to the court record established by Judge Szabo. This is the same Szabo that Terry Morris says used racist terms in regard to a person whose case he was adjudicating. This is the same Szabo who ruled against the defense on virtually every single one of 110 motions that they made during the court, who threw one of his lawyers out of the courthouse, who refused Mumia the right to represent himself, who went along with the exclusion of 9 or was it 10 black jurors in the case of the trial. So this is a Szabo whose court record Judge Yon says he will accept because the new law requires him to grant a presumption of correctness to it, even though the defense has demonstrated that Szabo's trial record is corrupt. Yon, who technically has the right to judge whether it was or wasn't, has decided that the good Judge Szabo did well. So right now where the case is, and I'm not sure about the technicalities, is Mumia may have the right to once again appeal the decision of Judge Demby to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. If that appeal right does not exist, then his case remains the property of Judge Yon, who has 29 some odd constitutional points that are before him, presented by the defense team, that he has to rule on. That is, whether or not Mumia was denied his right to counsel, whether or not the jury was truly a jury of his peers, or whether it was selected in a racist manner, whether or not Mumia's physical removal from the courtroom from majority of his own case where he could not hear the testimony against him or respond or collaborate with his attorney were factors that under the Constitution would mitigate against his receiving the death penalty and give him a new trial.
So basically, Judge Yon has made a decision. He has a two-part decision. He decided against Mumia on the new evidence, but he still is looking at the other half, which is the 29 violations of his rights, constitutional violations, and he
That's
still
exactly
has yet
okay.
to make a decision on that?
That's right.
Okay.
Judge Yon could pick any one of 29 or either other questions where Mumia's constitutional rights were violated. He, if he wanted, could say that the trial record by Judge Szabo was of such a corrupt level that it qualified as an exception under the AEDPA, where the court itself participated in the frame-up, which in this case they did, it's clear. Then they could set aside the decision of the jury and give Mumia a new trial.
What do you think the likelihood of that is?
Well, that gets down to the nub, I guess, of our interview, and that is that no one has ever felt in this case that Mumia's life rested in the goodwill or justice in the so-called criminal justice system. Everyone understands that whether or not Mumia receives justice is in our hands, not a criminal justice system that has the highest incarceration rate in the United States and that has the highest execution rate in the United States. So our view is that Mumia's freedom is in our hands. We have to struggle and build a very broad, massive social movement reaching out to every constituency in American society, from young people, the socialist left, conservatives, Republicans, Democrats, the church community, religious, labor, everyone who believes in democratic and human rights, to defend Mumia's interests. If they allow Mumia to be killed, they are going to allow justice to die with him. And what has happened to Mumia will happen to many, many more people. So we have to build a social movement to make the price of Mumia's execution too high to pay on the part of the powers that be. That's our job.
On December 4th, the City Council of Paris, France, declared Mumia Abu-Jamal an honorary citizen, making him the first person to receive the title since 1971, when Pablo Picasso was honored. Jean Viermos, leader of the Communist Party grouping on the City Council, said the symbolic moves comes in the wake of alarming news concerning the case. In response to Judge Dembe's decision and to commemorate Abu-Jamal's 20 years of unjust imprisonment, protest rallies were held worldwide. In Philadelphia, with a cold rain falling from the sky, about 1,000 people took to the streets to call for justice in the case. But the peaceful protest turned ugly when Philadelphia police attacked the marchers. Joining us live by telephone from Philadelphia is Taina Valle. She is with the International Concerned Family and Friends of Mumia Abu-Jamal and attended Saturday's rally. Thanks for joining us today, Taina. Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Thanks for having me.
Okay, can you begin by setting the scene for us at yesterday's rally? What was the mood there? Where did people gather? Where were people marching to?
Okay, well, we gathered in front of City Hall. It was a really rainy and cold day, but over 500 people showed up, which was really exciting, and it just goes to show the support that we have within this movement to free Mumia Abu-Jamal. We were really excited. Everything was very peaceful. We began to march to 13th Street and Locust Street, where the actual incident around this case occurred. And it was shortly after this point that the interruption by the police began.
I understand the trouble started when a female bystander began to heckle some of the marchers. Were you a witness to this, and can you tell us what happened?
I didn't actually see any female bystander heckling any of the marchers. I mean, that kind of thing happens when it's such a controversial issue and we're, you know, so outspoken marching through the streets. So that kind of thing happens. From what I saw, the actual interruption began when three police officers started running towards a young man in the march and threw their bikes down and pulled him out of the march and threw him to the ground. And, you know, a crowd proceeded to circle around this young man and the police officers. One police officer was holding pepper spray. And I was not a witness to this other part, but I have confirmation that another police officer was the one who was holding the young man down, was holding a gun to his neck and then briefly waved it at the crowd. It was from this point that other police officers began to come in and arrest people very randomly. I watched as, after this incident, I watched a photographer get pulled down and thrown to the ground. I watched as a reverend who was innocently marching in the rally, definitely was not inciting anything, was thrown to the ground and pushed into the street. I watched as two friends of mine, one a young woman, was grabbed by her hair by a police officer and was having her head waved in the air with his fist full of her hair. This same young woman was hospitalized with a broken tailbone and a possible damage to her rectum.
A broken tailbone. How did she sustain these injuries again?
Well, from what I understand, I didn't see. They did bring her to the ground, and I guess, according to her, she did pass out. And it was later on, when she was getting to the hospital, that she realized what had happened to her.
How many officers did it take to bring her down to the ground and arrest her?
I saw at least two or three officers around her, definitely two, possibly three, around her. And she definitely was not resisting arrest from what I saw. She was actually, in excruciating pain from them waving her head in the air with her hair. So she definitely was not, from what I saw, resisting arrest, nor was any of the other people that I saw get arrested.
Now, how many people in total were arrested?
There were eight people that were arrested, and two of them have been released with no charges.
Now, the two that were released, were these the two that were hospitalized?
Yes.
They were both?
Mm-hmm. They were hospitalized. There was actually another, the reverend that was arrested, he was actually released. He was also hospitalized because in the van, when they were taking him to the precinct, he started to get... he has heart problems, and he started to have some problems with his heart. Of the two young women that were hospitalized and arrested, one of them has a possible broken jaw.
Wow.
And the other one has definitely a tailbone fracture and possibly damage to her rectum. And she is actually, this is really important, she's actually sitting in jail right now with severe internal damage, and is receiving no hospital, no treatment for this damage. And, you know, it's really imperative that we get her out of jail. And so we're looking for people to send money to friends and family immediately to wire money to us so that we can get her out of jail.
What are people being charged with that are being imprisoned?
Well, there's two people who've been arraigned already. One of them is a young man who was charged with 8 felonies, and 4 of them are first degrees. Some of them, there are 3 assault charges and against him, 2 by police officers. And according to witnesses there was actually no confrontation that they saw. So it's really kind of coming out of nowhere from what the witnesses seem.
Did you yourself at any point see any of the participants in the demonstration strike at or hit a police officer?
I didn't see anybody strike at or hit a police officer. What I did see was, I saw people being pushed by police officers, being grabbed by police officers. I myself was pushed by police officers. Some people being hit with batons by police officers and trying to defend themselves from being hit and beaten. But I actually did not see anybody run up and attack a police officer at any time.
From your description, it sounds like a number of other people sustained injuries that were not arrested. Is that
Absolutely.
Correct?
Absolutely. There were a number of people when we gathered at the end of the protest that had, cuts on their lips, cuts on their back of their heads. People were hitting batons in their chest. People who have asthma problems were pepper sprayed and were having severe problems breathing. So, yes, many people did sustain injuries. I myself have a slight back injury from just being pushed around and thrown around by the police in the crowd. So, it was a very dangerous and frightening situation.
So what happened to the protest in March after these people were taken off to jail? Where did people go from there?
Well, from that point, we gathered. It's this area around Philadelphia called Rittenhouse Square. There's this place called the Ethical Society. We gathered in there where we began to take witnesses to what happened at the event and to talk a little bit more about the reasons why the pressure seems to be so hard on us to not speak out. By police officers and by the city of Philadelphia, and start to strategize on our next steps. And then, of course, meetings are going to be held, continual meetings are going to be held to take care of the situation. But right now, what we are really trying to do is contact anybody that we can to send money to get these people out of jail. We have the first young man that was arraigned has a bail of $68,000. So we need at least $6,830 just to get him out of jail. The next young woman who was arrested has an $80,000 bail, and she was a young woman. I actually didn't see this occur, but I have confirmation from a number of people that she was dragged in the street by her shirt. So now, by two police officers, a small young woman was dragged by two police officers by her shirt down the street for at least a block. Her collar was choking her, and her pants were down to her ankles, and her entire back was exposed and being dragged down the street for at least a block. She was actually a young woman who had a jaw injury, an injury to her jaw, and she has an $80,000 bail. So we need at least $8,000 to get her out of jail, and that does not even include the other people who have not been arraigned yet. And so that's another 4 people who have not been arraigned yet, who we need money for, and particularly the young woman with severe internal injuries that's sitting in jail right now.
Can you talk about the history of protests in Philadelphia around the Abu Jamal case? Is this out of character for the police department to crack down so hard on a Mumia demonstration?
Well, I'll tell you, in my experience with these rallies, and I've gone to a number of them, but again, I'm very young. This has been happening for a while. In my experience, I have never seen anything like this. You know, I know a couple of arrests have occurred here and there, but I've never seen anything like this, any kind of severe police interruption happen to this degree. But, you know, the history of police in Philadelphia as a whole, and particularly towards people who are speaking out against you know, city policies and government policies, has not been a very good record. You know, if you look at the Mumia Abu-Jamal case, or, you know, the case that happened with MOVE, or, you know, just with police brutality on an everyday basis, you know, or what happened with the anti-Republican convention rally, the rally against the Republican convention, you know, this isn't something that's new, but it is particularly new, I think, to these Mumia rallies, which just goes to show how the climate is heightened against activists in this country and people who speak out.
Now, it's been almost, or at least 24 hours since this event. What kind of media coverage has this protest gotten? Do you see the local media there talking about the issues that were trying to be raised at the protest, or are they even covering it, or are they just, and if they are covering it, are they just focusing on, you know, police brutality and violent protesters as they tend to do so well in the mainstream press?
Right. I mean, we all know the record of the mainstream press and how they, you know, cover little to none about what really happens at these events. And of course, the same is true in this case. You know, there has been little coverage about, you know, what happened at the rally. Very, very little coverage about, you know, why we were there, why we were protesting, and what has been said has been incorrect about you know, allegations of people attacking police and so on and so forth. So yeah, it's been very inaccurately covered.
All right, Taina Valle of the International Concerned Family and Friends of Mumia Abu-Jamal, I want to thank you for joining us today. What can our listeners do, to support those arrested at Saturday's demo, and where can they go for more information on the Abu-Jamal case?
Right. Well, it is extremely important that anybody that can donate any money towards, you know, towards the bail of these individuals, to call 215-476-5416, and to get also to get more involved with the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal, you can also check out the International Concerned Family and Friends of Mumia Abu-Jamal website at icffmaj@aol.com.
That's an email address?
I'm sorry, that's an email address, and the website address, excuse me, is www.mumia.org.
All right. Again, I want to thank you, Taina, for joining us today. You want to close on any final thoughts?
Boy, just, you know, let's keep speaking out. Let's not let the system intimidate us. You know, let's get our word out. Let's get our word out about what's going on with this war. Let's get our words out about what's going on with Mumia Abu-Jamal, and let's put it to a stop.
All right.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thanks for joining us today.
Bye-bye.
Bye. And that's all the time we have this week. Thanks for listening. The Weekly Freak Show is produced live in the studios of Freak Radio 96.3 FM in Santa Cruz, California, and can also be heard on Radio Lava Lamp, streaming out of Osaka, Japan, online at www.radiolavalamp.com. The interviews featured in this program are only a sample of the fine shows each week on Freak Radio. To hear it all, 24 hours a day, listen online at www.microradio.net/FRSC. That's www.microradio.net/FRSC. For questions and comments, send email to frsc@microradio.net. That's frsc@microradio.net, or snail mail to P.O. Box 7507, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. That's P.O. Box 7507, Santa Cruz, California, 95061, or call area code 831-427-4523. That's 831-427-4523. Thanks to the A-Info's Radio Project for distribution, our theme music was arranged and performed by Neil Norman and his Cosmic Orchestra. For Old Lady Scar Arms and everyone here at Freak Radio, my name's the V-Man, and that's a wrap.